Welcome to the Adoption and Foster Care Journey, a podcast to encourage, educate, and equip you to care for children and youth through adoption, foster, and kinship care. Hosted by an adoptive mom with over 22 years of kinship and adoptive parenting experience, she's on this journey with you. Please welcome Sandra Flack.
Wonderfully kind, tolerant, and patient God is with you? Does this mean nothing to you? Can't you see that His kindness is intended to turn you from sin? Well, that is Romans chapter 2, verse 4 from the New Living Translation. I'm Sandra Flack. Welcome to this episode of the Adoption and Foster Care Journey. Thank you for taking the time to join us today. I pray that you will be encouraged by your time invested listening to this episode. We have the brilliant Dr. Jared Brown with us today to talk about attachment. So grab a notebook and a pen. We've done multiple episodes with Dr. Brown. He is a wealth of information. He takes us to school. So you're going to want your notebook, something to take notes in or notes on. If you're listening to this while you're driving or walking, you're going to want to listen again a second time with something to take notes with, I assure you. So before we get to our conversation with Dr. Brown, though, I would like to remind you or let you know, if you're a first-time listener, about a vital resource for foster, adoptive, and kinship caregivers that I offer. So check this out.
Natalie Vecchione of the FASD Hope Podcast and Sandra Flack of the Adoption and Foster Care Journey Podcast would like to invite you to join their Hope for the FASD Journey, a virtual support community for parents and caregivers raising individuals with an FASD, diagnosed or not. This faith-based community includes an online bi-monthly support group, a monthly VIP conversation, and a private Facebook group which includes a video devotional from Natalie and Sandra every Saturday. To register, visit justicefororphansny.org/training/FASD.
So while this podcast is not specifically just about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, or FASD, we do talk about it a lot on this show. I am a mom of an 18-year-old and a 20-year-old, both adopted and diagnosed when they were little with fetal alcohol syndrome. But way back then, there were no resources, just kind of doom and gloom, scary information out there on the web. And so we had nothing for a long time. We did dive into the connected parenting stuff, the TBRI, Empowered to Connect, all of that stuff, which helped, and I highly recommend to every foster and adoptive parent and kinship caregiver. But it wasn't enough because our kids had been prenatally exposed to alcohol and we needed much, much more. So over the years, I've gotten professional training so that I can support you, other adoptive, foster, and kinship caregivers who are raising kids who are prenatally exposed to alcohol or other drugs. Most of the time, our kids are not diagnosed or they're misdiagnosed, and we're dealing with all kinds of big behaviors, and we really don't know what's going on or why or what to do about it. So that is one of the reasons I am here. So we talk about it a lot on this podcast, but we also offer the support group you just heard about, and we offer online and in-person training. So monthly, pretty much, I offer a free online lunch and learn, I usually call it. It's an hour workshop where you can learn all of the basics about FASD. It is great for you if you don't know that much about it or you want to know a little bit more about it, but it's also great for those who are in a relationship with your kiddos. So think about grandparents, adult siblings, next door neighbors, babysitters, youth group leaders, Sunday school teachers, anyone out there, school teachers, bus drivers, anybody out there interacting with your kids who may really need to know a little bit more about your kiddos and their, you know, how they're wired and why they are, you know, their brains actually work differently. So the next one coming up is going to be offered on March 20th. So it is right around the corner. You just got a couple of days. If you're listening to this podcast on the day that we drop it, which is always a Monday, you've just got a couple of days to take advantage of that. And you can find that sign up, even though it's free, you have to register so you can get the Zoom link. So sign up for that or check out any of our other workshops that we offer or that are on the schedule already that you can sign up for. You do that at our website, justicefororphansny.org. And there's a link in the show notes, of course, so you can find that super easy. But also, I offer coaching. So if you would like a one-on-one, you know, maybe just schedule an hour with me to begin to explore this, unpack it a little bit and see if maybe you want to do, you know, some coaching sessions. I schedule those, you know, pretty much based on your schedule and my schedule. So it can be a daytime, it can be an evening. If you want to do once a week, once a month, twice a month, very flexible in the scheduling of that. So you can learn more about that also on the website. If you are in the North Carolina area, I will be leading an FASD workshop at the Renew Retreat on April 18th through 20th, 2024. It is in Swansburg, North Carolina, near the beach. So if you are in North Carolina or you want to drive or fly, I highly, highly recommend this retreat. It is faith-based. It is organized by the amazing Jody Jackson Tucker, who is author of the Second Mother's Bible Study. And she's just an incredible adoptive mom herself who pours into the rest of us all the time. So hopefully, maybe that's something you can get to. I will be there. Like I said, I'll be teaching a workshop on FASD. If you want to learn more about the retreat or you want to register, you would go to renewretreat.org. Again, there's a link in the show notes to make it easier for you. And as always, I always like to ask if you would subscribe or follow this podcast, leave a review, follow us on YouTube. We have a YouTube channel if you don't know that yet. If you like to watch your podcasts, if you do that for us, it just makes it easier for the next adoptive or foster parent to find us when they're searching for a podcast about adoption or foster care. So we want them to be able to find this amazing resource. So help us out and do that. So there we go. Now to our favorite returning guest. Dr. Jared Brown is a professor, a trainer, researcher, consultant with multiple years of experience in teaching at the college level. He is the founder and CEO of the American Institute for the Advancement of Forensic Studies. Jared has provided consultation services to caregivers, professionals, and organizations on the topics of autism spectrum disorder, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, confabulation, suggestibility, trauma, and other life adversities, including alexithymia, executive dysfunction, criminal recidivism, traumatic brain injury, and youth fire setting. Jared has completed 4 separate master's degree programs and holds graduate certificates in neuroscience and the law, neuropsychology, autism, other health disabilities, and traumatic brain injury. In 2021, Jared completed a postdoctoral certificate in leadership and organizational strategy and a professional certificate in forensic psychology. In 2023, he completed a diabetes care and education certificate and is currently, as if he doesn't already know a whole lot already, he is currently pursuing his 5th master's degree in applied clinical nutrition from Northeast College of Health Services. Jared has conducted over 200 workshops and webinars and on-demand trainings for various organizations and professional and student audiences. He's published several articles and book chapters and recently co-edited the book, Forensic Mental Health, a Source Guide for Professionals. Jared has been quoted in various magazine and newspaper articles and is regularly featured on national and international podcast programs like this one. And hey, he is also, it's my favorite part, a foster parent. So please welcome back our resident expert on all the things, Dr. Jared Brown. Hey, Jared, welcome back.
Hey, Sandra. Thanks for having me. Always happy to be here.
Oh, it's always an honor to have you. I always tell our listeners you're going to take us to school because you take us deep into the topics that we're discussing, which we always, always appreciate, including today on attachment and parenting. So for our listeners, you know, just to know where we're coming from here, let's start with a definition on what you mean by attachment-informed parenting.
So when we are informed about attachment through a parenting lens, you're probably going to be more sensitive and attuned to your child's previous trauma history. So let's say you're a foster care parent, adoptive parent. Most of the time, a child is going to be coming out of an environment that probably has some trauma, even if they're coming out of a bad situation into a great situation. That's still trauma. You're leaving one situation to another. So that is a disruption. So we need to take that into account because attachment really is the foundation of a house. And that's what we build on, because without a solid attachment base, what can happen? We're more likely to grow up and have headaches, depression, anxiety, school problems. We're much more likely to have a drug or alcohol problem, come into contact with the justice system. By no means am I saying everyone that has attachment problems is going to have that happen. But if you look at drug and alcohol treatment centers, you look at the prison systems, you look at mental health centers, you peel the layers back, what do you find? A lot of times, lots of trauma in childhood. And probably in utero, but most of these places, I don't think, have training in utero stuff and ask questions about that. But we really want to be aware of any experiences of trauma or any experiences of attachment, fractures, disruptions from conception to the point your child was placed with you. And hopefully, Sandra, I haven't shared this with you, but I hope we can do an episode this year on the first 1,000 days of life research, because I think that ties in nicely to what I share, because I love the first 1,000 days of life research, because what that is day one of conception all the way to age two. And what that research says is that's probably the most important part of a human being's life. That's really going to help shape and guide and inform their view of the world, their view of themselves, their brain. So during that first 1,000 days of life, in an ideal world, the pregnancy would have been free from drugs and alcohol. Mom would have been eating properly, having good prenatal care in a really stable, loving environment. But unfortunately, kids who are in the foster care arena and adoption, a lot of times, that did not happen. So there are disruptions in utero and in early childhood, but it's not set as well. So let's say the child had horrific traumas happen to them, then placed with you as the caregiver. Yes, that child probably is going to have some challenges, sensory, language, attention, sleep, eating problems, but early intervention is key. So the earlier you can intervene around all of these things, eating healthier, managing your stress, being a regulated caregiver, making sure your environment is safe and free of all kinds of not so good stuff, taking care of yourself, staying regulated, all those things are very helpful and maybe help reset the clock, help that child start developing some healthy attachment patterns. So the first 1,000 days of life literature helps guide and inform me when I look at it through this lens. So that's a solid, that's a mini introduction into attachment. So when you study attachment, you want to learn about attachment theory. So you probably want to look at some of the work of Bowlby and Ainsworth, the older attachment literature. depending on what study you look at, what author you really subscribe to, there's different kinds of attachment patterns out there. But they really, if you look deep in the weeds, they really just, they fall under two umbrellas. Secure attachment, where probably things went well, there wasn't trauma, and that child has a very secure attachment base. And then there's insecure attachment. Under the umbrella of insecure attachment, you can have all kinds of different dimensions, like anxious attachment.
Right.
You could have dismissive attachment. There's all kinds of different dimensions, but disrupted attachment patterns, very common. How do we disrupt our attachment patterns? Trauma, mm-hmm. neglect, inconsistent caregiving. Maybe there was medical trauma. Maybe there was no like physical abuse, neglect, trauma, but that child growing up had a lot of medical health issues and was consistently rushed to the ER or had a lot of broken bones or surgeries. So we got to consider any kind of trauma, medical, spiritual trauma, refugee trauma, if children from other countries relocating, growing up in homelessness, poverty, domestic violence exposure, the adverse childhood experiences. So that's kind of the beginning points where you want to consider this. And I think most people who get training in trauma and attachment think that attachment really is formed after birth. It begins in utero. Attachment mm-hmm. starts in utero, because what happens if there's attachment-based traumas in utero? Unfortunately, what happens if the pregnancy was a result of a sexual assault mm-hmm. and the mom had no interest in being pregnant? There's no connection to that child. And it was a result of, unfortunately, a rape or sexual assault. That's an attachment trauma that happened in utero. Mm-hmm. What happens during pregnancy? Mom is being abused. She's in a domestic violence situation. So you have her trauma being passed down to her developing child in utero as well. Mom using drugs, alcohol, tobacco products, malnutrition, secondary trauma that the mom is witnessing, but maybe it's not happening to her directly, but she's living in an environment where it's just scary and chaotic and she's seeing terrible things. All of those things during pregnancy are not only a trauma for mom, but that developing baby in utero, which then can impact that baby's brain in utero at a neurobiological level. So we have neuroscience, biological could be like oxytocin disruptions, hormone disruptions, mm-hmm. neurochemical issues. So it's a lot going on with attachment besides what happens after birth. We have to consider the first 1,000 days of life.
Wow, that is so fascinating. And I definitely want to do an episode on the first 1,000 days of life now that you're mentioning that. Because before you said that, I was started thinking, I hear from people, and it's a misconception. And I think in the adoption community, once you're in and on this journey, you know the answer to this. But people on the outside looking in, or people who aren't well versed with adoption, there's a misconception that if you get the baby at birth, if the adoptive parents are in the delivery room and get to cut the cord, that everything will be great and there's no worries and there won't be anything wrong with the child. But that's not necessarily true, because if there's trauma in utero, that's already happening then. Can you speak to that?
Potentially have 9 months of horrific trauma that have happened to that child before you even have picked up the child or met the child in the delivery room. And in some cases, depending on the level of trauma in utero, you could also have birth trauma. Mm-hmm. You could have an early delivery. And depending on how early that pregnancy was delivered, that opens up a whole other can of worms, because the research literature on that also shows that early delivery can lead to all kinds of issues as well. It really depends on a host of factors, of course, but I've consulted on numerous cases where adoptive parents have got the child at birth or a few days or a few weeks after, have done all the right things, but that child still grows up and does have some challenges. And the challenges stem from a lot of the things that happen before being placed with that family. And it's so hard to say what's going to happen because every brain is different. Genetics does factor into this in some cases. What kind of interventions were put into place? Mm-hmm. Nutrition is a huge factor, I think, we don't take into account. What I will say is most of the cases I've consulted on where the adoptive parent or the foster care parent gets the child out of a horrific situation, they're really good about using attachment, sensory, language, speech, there, all those things. But one common theme that I don't see emerge that much is considering the role and impact too that the gut plays and what that child eats. Yeah. So that's a whole nother, two other major variables that you have to take into account, because those are factors too that can help heal that brain that was damaged or severely impacted before that child even came to you.
Yeah, so fascinating. And it makes me think of my four boys, or not my four adopted, internationally adopted kids who are siblings. The older two had been with the birth parents until they were like 3 and 5, but the younger two, and when they were 3 and 5, they were found and placed into an orphanage. So it wasn't in the United States where they would have gone into foster care. So they were in an orphanage system. Parental rights had been terminated, but birth mom has two more babies after that. And both of those babies, she abandoned at the hospital. So went to the hospital, gave birth, and then left them there. So there is significant more trauma for two reasons with our kiddos. I'm thinking this very scenario that I just explained, you know, there was an attachment in utero. Mom knew she wasn't going to be keeping these babies. I'm sure she had tremendous stress about whatever was going on in her life anyway. And they were prenatally exposed to alcohol. So, and then, you know, talk about the first 1,000 days. One of them was in the orphanage until they were 3, and the other one was in the orphanage until he was 5. So all of these things, you know, make up adverse, you know, childhood experiences, but can contribute to the attachment piece that we're talking about today.
Without a doubt. Yeah. And it's difficult. It's very difficult, but never give up hope, because there's always things we can do to make it better. I'm not going to lie to people, in some situations, depending on the severity of the trauma, it might not be able to be cured, but it can get a lot better. And we know the triggers more frequently. Maybe for some of these kids, they need extra sleep because their brains just are overwhelmed. They get more fatigued during the day. For some of these kids, they might be extremely sensitive to food dyes or sugars or excessive screen time exposure. All of these things we have to take into account as part of a holistic, integrative approach with an attachment and trauma-based lens and executive function, really, to help these kids do the best possible they can do. A couple things really to think about is some of these kids may not do well in school programs as usual. It's not a bad thing. It just is what it is. They may do better in a very small, structured environment. Some of these individuals, as they get older, may not do well in a traditional work setting. It's not as much as we would like them to thrive in a setting where it's business as usual, they may need supports and structures and accommodations the rest of their life in some cases. But if we know that, you can teach that child these things, they no longer become a limitation or weakness. It's just something I live with. This is something I have to be aware of. These are all things I've consulted on. It's hard for some foster care adoptive parents I've consulted with to think about these things at first, that I've done all these right things. I've gone to all these therapies for years and years and years, and you're telling me that maybe my child will not be able to be in a traditional college program or a standard job. Maybe not, because of the sensory issues, the processing speed, the suggestibility, the gullibility, the executive function. So those are things just to take into account. But again, every child is different. and what we do, how we react, and what supports we put into place can make a world of difference as well.
Yeah. And I know for me, when my boys were diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome, when they were young, I think they were 6 and 8. There were no, way back then when I researched that online, it was just dark and hopeless and doom and gloom. And, but we did dive into the one thing that we had discovered at that point in time. And that was the connected parenting. So if you're familiar with Dr. Karen Purvis and her work and trust-based relational intervention, I think a lot of our listeners are probably very familiar with that book and TBRI. And those things helped with our kids. I feel like I can look back now and feel like, because we didn't know about it until we adopted our last son, our last one, who is now 18. So we applied all of those principles, the connecting and empowering and all of that. And it worked. It definitely worked. I feel like I can say we've got great connection, great attachment. But we reached a certain point when they became teenagers, when we clearly felt like something else is going on here. And what is it? And that's when we had to revisit the whole FASD subject. And by then there was more out there. And then I went on to get some professional training and so I can help other people as well as our own family. But so many of our kids, I would say that every kid that comes into foster care, adoption, a kinship placement, there's been some trauma, right? There's some kind of trauma going on that has happened. And so that's definitely the case. So we need all of, these interventions that we're going to be talking about today, but then many of them are also diagnosed, having, maybe they're not diagnosed, but they've also been exposed to alcohol in the womb, maybe exposed to drugs in the womb. And that sort of compounds the whole situation, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I've consulted on cases too, where that's been the situation. But on top of that, STD exposure in utero, malnutrition, maternal obesity, maternal untreated diabetes, premature birth, you name it. There's fortunately a case I consulted on. The mom was in a domestic violence situation and hit so hard in the stomach while pregnant, there was suspicion that the baby sustained a head injury in utero on top of meth exposure, on top of tobacco exposure, very sad cases. And there's varying levels of trauma, but it's real, it's alive and well. And if a child is in the foster care arena, child protection arena, they've had trauma of some sort, without a doubt. And depending on the level of trauma, the research is very clear. If you can understand the various neurobiological systems that are impacted by early childhood trauma and attachment disruptions, it will help you, I think, be more sensitive and informed with your parenting. So when I say neurobiological systems, there's four you'd want to be aware of. There's many more, but the HPA axis, we've done that in a previous episode, the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis. That's absolutely talked about. You have to understand that. That's our body's main stress response system and a hormone regulator. The nervous system. I believe we did an episode on the central nervous system. Absolutely, if a child was exposed to drugs or alcohol in utero, their nervous system could be overly sensitive or under respond. So you could have really hyper arousal, irritability, anger, rage control, sleep issues, eating problems, or you could have a child that's just very lethargic and it just seems like that child is so disconnected from themselves or the world. The amygdala is absolutely impacted when we're talking about this. The amygdala is part of the brain's limbic system. You ever had a fear response? You ever get really startled and your heart races and you're jumpy? And that's your amygdala kicking in. For people who have had trauma, their amygdala, it's like the fight or flight response. Yeah. They're hypervigilant. They're looking over their shoulder. Amygdala kicks in. What happens? Our prefrontal cortex shuts down. Yep. We talk about FASD. Everyone with FASD has executive function impairments. So on top of that, then when they're emotionally aroused and they're hyped up, lots of anger, whatever's going on, prefrontal cortex isn't working that well anyway. Right. So decision-making, reasoning, planning, logic just goes out the window. So the person just bases everything on how they feel in that moment. And if someone goes through life only basing it on how they feel, I see this all the time. What happens? Rage control issues sometimes go up, stress eating, road rage, getting into fights, using drugs to cope, using tobacco to cope. So they haven't learned those good coping skills. So those would be the big four neurobiological systems to be aware of: the hypothalamus, pituitary, adrenal axis, the central nervous system, the amygdala, and the prefrontal cortex. Many more, but those are kind of the big four I would say start with. And I believe we've done episodes on three of the four of them. We haven't done one on the amygdala, which could be another one to maybe consider.
Definitely. Because I kept thinking I can like one of my kiddos fits into all those categories. And I'm like, oh, we would definitely love to do an episode on the amygdala for sure. It also makes me think of RAD, reactive attachment disorder, because there's a lot of kiddos who get that diagnosis. Sometimes I think that could actually be secondary. You know, when we think about FASD and there's primary symptoms and then secondary, you know, the description of RAD could be secondary, because we're not adequately supporting the individual with the primary symptoms. But could you discuss RAD a little bit and where that comes into play here?
So in the DSM-5 now, reactive attachment disorder, they're separated into two disorders now: reactive attachment disorder and disinhibited social engagement disorder. Wow. Those are probably the most extreme attachment-based disorders out there. And I think a lot of people have the misconception that many, many kids in foster care have reactive attachment disorder.
Right.
It's really, they have attachment problems, but true reactive attachment disorder, it's not as common as you think. And the research says that RAD is one of the most understudied and misunderstood disorders in the DSM-5. So reactive attachment disorder, more externalizing behaviors. You could see more yelling or screaming or like, get away from me, I want nothing to do with you. Mm-hmm. But it can present differently with every child. Disinhibited social engagement disorder would be a child that has indiscriminate friendliness, where they don't have any stranger danger. They don't look back at mom or dad when running up to a stranger. That can be very, very scary for parents, especially foster care parents. And it could place that child at harm's way of victimization as they get older. So those would be the two to be aware of. When we look at this through the neurobiological lens, through attachment disruption, as someone gets older, research is very clear on this too. An elevated number of people who are diagnosed with a personality disorder, eating disorders, disassociated kinds of disorders, and addictive disorders may actually have disrupted attachment patterns early on in life. And from a medical lens, this is where it gets interesting. Fractured attachment patterns may place the person at greater risk for medical health issues as he or she gets older. Chronic pain has been noted to go up. It could be an accelerant for cardiovascular disease issues. And it's partially mediated by inflammation. So chronic low-grade inflammation over the long haul wreaks havoc on our body. And poor attachment oftentimes equals lots of trauma, not always, and maybe more poor coping skills. So then if that person has a lot of poor coping skills throughout life, do they smoke cigarettes? Are they binge drinking? Are they pounding down the energy drinks, the sugar sweetened beverages, the fast food? Are they not sleeping? Are they not exercising? So you couple all that with the inflammation over many, many years and decades, that wreaks havoc on the body, which then equals more body pain and blood sugar dysregulation, all kinds of things. So Why do you want to focus on attachment? Because it's almost a force field, a protective shield. The more solid, secure attachment base someone has, it helps us handle stress better. When depression does come up, we're more likely to tap into healthy coping strategies than unhealthy. It's a protective factor against loneliness. It can help improve our social relationships. We do better in school. The list goes on and on and on.
Yeah. So the kiddos, say, in foster care that are kind of bounced from foster home to foster home to foster home, that's where you're getting the fracture, right?
Yeah, you had the initial fracture going into the foster care arena.
Right.
And depending on the severity of the needs for that child, some foster care parents may not be equipped. Maybe they were blindsided in some case. They just didn't know, and they just call their worker. We can't handle this.
Yeah.
Next placement, next placement. Eventually, maybe you run out of placements and the child is placed in kind of a group home environment where there's lots of other kids in there. And I've consulted on cases like that too. So yeah, the more placements, what does that mean? The child in some cases will maybe feel like they're defective, unlovable. What's wrong with me? They develop a wall around them. They don't trust people, which of course I probably wouldn't either. If you go place to place to place, and do they feel unworthy? So breaking that
Rejection.
cycle, absolutely. Yeah.
I know
Snowball effect in a way.
in New York State, where I am based, there and I think this is also a national trend as well, preventative services. So, and more of a focus on kinship care. So trying to get a child who comes in, who's going to come into care rather than go into a traditional foster home with a family they don't know, it's the focus is to try to get either a relative or a friend of the family to take the child. So I think it, that's definitely a better practice. But at the same time, you have, these potential caregivers who haven't really had the training that the foster parents have had. They don't understand. They may not even, because, several years ago, back in 1999, so lots of years ago, when we welcomed our first kiddo into our family through kinship, we didn't have any formal training. It wasn't through foster care. She wasn't in the system yet, but we stepped in before it became that. But we got cu legal custody of her, but her mom had died, abandonment at birth, as an infant by the birth father, and then being cared for by a mentally ill and physically unhealthy grandparent before she came to live with us. So, coming to live with us was, while that was a great thing, we didn't know anything about anything. We had no formal training. So I'm not sure how much training, if grandma's going to take the grandkids, how much training there is there, but yet there's still the trauma piece comes into play, and then a lot of these other things, whatever was going on, that could even be prenatal exposure, things like that, where the kinship caregiver may really have no idea what to do or what, why the behaviors are the way they are.
Doubt at all. Because if we're talking about a child that's exposed in utero to chemicals, fractured attachment patterns, lots of trauma, traditional parenting and traditional consequences,
Don't work.
I don't think they work, at least what I've ever seen and heard. So then the kinship, if a person's living with an aunt or uncle, cousin, whatever, grandma and grandpa, yes, it's good to try to keep folks with biological people, but every case is different. Individualization, what's their capacity? What's their level of interest in even raising that child? Or do they just feel like they have to and it's their obligation, even though they just don't want to? And it can go either way. It's very, very tricky. But the more we can become aware of these topics. Now, attachment and trauma, very foundational, but it stems from there. There's all kinds of other things to consider under this umbrella. Joint attention is one I would recommend your audience to be aware of. Social referencing, mind-mindedness, theory of mind, distorted cognitive schema, and all of those could be topics in and of themselves. Those are just search terms for your audience. If you want to truly understand everything I'm talking about today, learn about all those other moving parts. And those are just a few I threw out. But behavior is complex, especially when we're talking about fractured attachment, trauma, in utero exposure. The more you can understand these moving parts, then you're going to be in a better position to probably have more empathy, more patience, and realize we look at the long game. This is stuff that's probably not going to go away in a few weeks, a few months, or a few years. But it can get better every year. Every year it's getting better and better and better. So,
yeah. And how does, we talked a little bit about this, but I keep thinking about, you know, we have the trauma piece, definitely, you know, a kiddo definitely has that. And when there is other, you know, conditions such as whether it be FASD or ADHD or, you know, autism, any of those things, when it's a, you know, compounded, in other words, how do we know with the behaviors that are appear, you know, that are presenting those difficult behaviors, how do we know, is this trauma or is this because of ADHD, or is this trauma or is it because they were prenatally exposed to alcohol? Like, how do we know, or does it matter that we know? Can we treat it all the same? Is it the same response?
You may not ever know with certainty, depending on maybe you don't have good birth records, something like that. Those are things to be aware of. But this is me. People could disagree, but I think we have to start with attachment and trauma as being the foundation and then build from there. Dig deeper. Is it FASD? Is it in utero exposure to meth or cocaine, whatever it is? If you can't ever find that out, but if you look through an attachment lens, a trauma lens, an executive function lens, that's the kicker too. A lot of attachment-informed and trauma-informed organizations forget about the executive function piece, because everyone that's had these histories probably has executive function. So treatment as usual probably doesn't work. Punishments and things like that, consequences as usual don't work because of the abstract reasoning deficits, connecting the dots, seeing the forest through the trees, understanding how and why questions can be tricky. So if you were to add on to the good work you're already doing and weave in executive function approaches as well as metacognitive approaches, which I think we did an episode on metacognition, thinking about thinking, knowing about knowing.
Yeah.
Those big three are going to make a huge difference. But here's the other kicker too. If the child is not sleeping well and they're not eating well and they're never exercising and they have profound gut health issues, all those other things oftentimes aren't as effective. So you can do all the wonderful things, but if you're a family that loves your pizza and your fast food and your sugar sweetened beverages, for a child that has all of these traumas, that's just inflaming their gut, throwing off their hormones, throwing off their neurotransmitters, their blood sugar levels. Everything just gets blown up. So it's a really holistic approach, and it takes a lot of intentionality, but it can make a difference if you infuse all of these into kind of this big, complex puzzle. That's what I think works the best from what I have seen over the years. I could be wrong, but that's kind of where I'm at today.
Yeah. And it makes me think of why, say, a kinship caregiver and, I was, my daughter is now in her 30s. So I don't know if you can say I'm still, but that's how we got started. So I have experience there. And I know many kinship caregivers, but that's why it's so important for them to have training and understanding on this, because you know, what maybe they say, if it's a grandparent, how they traditionally parented their children who are now adults and now they're, you know, getting the grandkids and they're raising them. It's not the same parenting tools. And you really have to have that understanding of executive function, because that is a big, you know, that's a big one. But I can see why traditional parenting, you know, we use that, right? That's what we knew. And that's what we tried with our daughter, but our kiddos don't learn from consequences. And then it becomes a barrier to building connection also. So So it's so important that every, you know, every adoptive, foster, and kinship caregiver have an understanding of attachment, connection, and then all of the other topics that we're talking about, because it definitely, it's all vital to this journey of caring for kids with adverse childhood experiences.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't know how much time we have left, but do you want me to give some interventions, some tips, yes, some strategies?
That was my next question. You know, what can parents and caregivers do to build attachment? What will help? Give us some guidelines here.
Maybe a future episode, we could do something on neuroparenting. I'm actually putting together a training on that. But if you're an attachment-informed parent, by default, you're really a trauma-informed parent. You have to be, because you can't have these profound attachments without trauma.
Right.
But then if you tack on neuroeducation and neuroparenting approaches, you're going to have a great appreciation for executive function, CEO of the brain, self-regulation, huge topic, theory of mind, perspective taking, alexithymia, emotional blindness, language, speech and communication abilities, sensory processing abilities. So bright lights, cologne, perfume, multitasking could be really tricky. A neural parent will also take into account your child's processing speed.
Yes.
So maybe that child can't take in a lot of words. So you might be a neural parent who uses less words. You don't multitask. You stay regulated. You have a great appreciation for abstract thinking and reasoning abilities, because those are probably limited in children with these backgrounds. You make a focus on health and wellness. Obvious, I'm not giving medical advice, talk to your doctor, but focusing on improving sleep, your nutrition, and movement, getting plenty of exercise, but talk to the doctor, because some kids with these backgrounds may have joint pain, mobility issues, with some kinds of exercise might be not good, especially if a child's riding a bike and they have bad mobility, they could wipe out and hit their head. Consulted on two cases where that was an issue. So maybe it's chair yoga or heated pool therapy or some modified structured exercise intervention. And then also having a really good appreciation for inflammation, blood sugar dysregulation, and gut brain health access functioning. That's a lot I've thrown at you guys, but I think, Sandra, we have done episodes on almost all those topics, not all, but almost all. So neuroparenting, that would be a good thing to be aware of. Basic things with attachment parenting: love, kindness, empathy, stability, being sensitive, modeling healthy behavior. If you are a well-regulated parent, you're teaching your child to be a well-regulated adult. If you are a dysregulated parent and you fly off the handle at your child is probably more likely to grow up to model that behavior.
Yeah.
Promote relationship safety and stability, predictability, consistency, using parental warmth. Because children with lots of trauma can be very sensitive to voice tone and even facial expressions. Be very mindful of the facial cues, the expressions you have. That can play a role. Parents who can enhance their own parental self-efficacy, and they can get training and learn about this stuff, they're in a much better position to believe in their own ability to be an effective parent. Promoting resilience in yourself and in your entire family system. Sitting down as a family for mealtime. If you get time, everyone, just Google the benefits of shared mealtime together. The list is this long, long, long. It promotes empathy, connectiveness. Kids who eat with their families every night or every day are much less likely to go to prison as adults. They're less likely to have drug problems. They learn conflict resolution skills. They're happier. And that's a family that puts their gadgets in a basket or doesn't sit at the table while multitasking. Just sit and talk to each other.
Yeah.
Get off the screen. I mean, all these things can be helpful.
Yeah. And it sounds pretty you know, just sort of simple, almost the things, you know, practical things. So just for our listeners' benefit, what is neuroparenting?
It's basically the infusion of neuroscience research into parenting practices. So really recognizing, especially if you're raising a child that maybe has a brain that has had some insults to it before mm-hmm. the child came to you, you take into account that child's brain may operate differently. They may learn differently. They may need a different approach. So you're really sensitive to your child's learning, mm-hmm. memory, attention, capabilities, any kind of goal plan, intervention, treatment plan. If you infuse neuroscience into it, it's probably going to be more effective than business as usual, treatment as usual approaches. So it's the infusion of neuroscience, research, practices, approaches into parenting practices.
Yeah, it reminds me of what I do when I teach on FASD and teaching about, you know, brain differences and, you know, what does my kiddo's brain have to do with this behavior that we're seeing? And then how can we better support? So is it a sensory processing thing? Is it slow processing? A language, you know, the abstract, you know, versus concrete concepts, all of those different things, the dismaturity, all of those different things that we call symptoms, primary symptoms of FASD, you know, all stemming from how the brain works or works differently, and then parenting accordingly, not expecting, okay, you have to change, you know, the kiddo has to change, but rather the environment. How can we modify the environment and what can we do to help support the kid? Is that along the same lines?
Absolutely. I mean, we're using different terms, but yeah. We're coming to the same conclusion, and everything you said would be a component of being a neuroparent.
Wow. Love that. I hadn't heard the term neuroparent, but I think that's what I am.
And there's neuroeducators. There's a whole line of literature on college professors, K-12 teachers. If you become a neuroscience-informed educator, your curriculum will probably be more successful. Your classroom design and setup will be much more effective for every child. The way you interact with coworkers is going to be better. So a lot of good research on all those things.
And that's what... I think we're lacking in the educator department, you know, especially those of us. I interact with so many adoptive and foster parents caring for kids with an FASD, and the struggle at school is always, it's always a battle to get the right supports and services at school, because as an FASD being an invisible disability, you know, even, you know, school administrators and teachers look at the behaviors and they just see a kid who is, you know, lazy or not willing to try or not putting any effort in, or, you know, the whole long list of things that they get labeled with, without understanding that this could be how their brain works.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've talked to lots of educators for the last few years, and I hear it consistently. The challenges have been amplified since COVID.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It just seems like more and more and more behavioral needs. I've heard this enough too with some teachers in Minnesota. We're seeing more and more kids and more parents high on marijuana. I mean, mm-hmm. that's a whole nother can of worms and stuff. Yeah. And hearing that frequently now on just different things I'm involved with, talking to different professionals and caregivers.
Yeah. Well, also drinking among women increased significantly during COVID. As did, you know, pregnancy. So I think it's a matter of time and not much more time before we will start seeing our schools, you know, experiencing an uptick in kids with these things, and not, again, a lot of them don't recognize what's really going on or where it's coming from.
Doesn't seem like it's getting better. It's just getting worse on a large scale level.
Yeah. Well, we talked about so many things. So just to wrap up, maybe one, well, maybe give us up to three. What is the first three things our listeners could do if they're thinking, okay, I have to build attachment. I have to be more trauma informed. What are the first, like, if somebody could walk away with just three things that they know they could do, to begin improving things here, what would they be? What would it be?
Three things. All right, let me think about this. So
a hard one.
Trauma, trauma, attachment, neuro-informed parenting, which would equal executive function. So that counts as one. So hopefully I'll that's
okay,
one.
I'll let you slide with that.
But then after that, just again, my training, my brain always goes to get sleep under control, because that's number one to health.
Yeah.
You get better sleep, you fix the gut, and you eat really healthy. And then you weave in the neuro, the attachment, the trauma. It's a holistic,
yes,
integrative approach. And not one professional has expertise in all these areas. So it's usually, again, tapping into lots of professionals. Hopefully it's a wraparound program. They're talking to each other. You're developing some sort of joint education intervention plan. And again, with the parents too, if you're not modeling this behavior, it only can go so far. So really getting the whole family on board with eating healthy, exercising as a family, getting good sleep, managing stress. I mean, sitting down as a family and having mealtime. If you're telling your child to get off the screen while you're on your screen, I mean, that's probably not going to be that helpful. Yeah. So just modeling the behavior. We're all guilty of that stuff, but just doing it together as a family and getting buy-in and educating everyone why this is important, why we're doing it. Yeah. And maybe connecting with other families and doing it with other families, it's much more likely to stick, and you're probably going to have greater success with it. And then your body's going to work better. Your brain's going to work better. Your gut's going to work better. Your hormones are in balance. You're going to be more well-rested as a parent. So then you're going to be more patient, more resilient when things do get maybe more amplified, and you can stay regulated and you're consistently modeling healthy ways to manage stress to your child. And these are all things I think can make a huge difference.
Yeah. Love it. Love it. Thank you so much for taking us to school again, Dr. Brown, and for just all of your wisdom and your input, your expertise that we value. We will look forward to having another episode. We'll do another episode with you next month. And hopefully have, not sure what the topic will be yet. We'll figure it out, but our listeners can stay tuned to that. But thank you again for joining us today.
Thank you, Sandra. Thank you, everyone.
Oh my goodness. I could just sit and talk forever with Dr. Brown. If you were watching this on YouTube, you probably noticed I kept looking down because I was scribbling notes. I don't even know if I can read my own handwriting. I scribbled so much, but just such a wealth of information that I believe is so, so helpful to us. And that wrap-up question, you know, it really is a holistic approach. And it might have sounded with all of the things that he was talking to us about, that Dr. Brown was saying, it can sound overwhelming, like, where do I even start? But he really wrapped it up in the end. It's a holistic approach. We can all start with paying attention to the gut. And this is for our kiddos, right? For our children, pay attention to their gut, what they're eating, their nutrition, and their sleep. Those are things we can start working on now. And then add those other things as you begin to learn more. We've done way over 20 episodes with Dr. Brown since the fall of 2022. So if you were to scroll back in our catalog of podcasts and look for those episodes, there's over 20 of them. Such invaluable information. I would get a notebook, a Dr. Jared Brown notebook, because every episode you're going to want to take notes. And I've learned so much. I learned, you know, like alexithymia and different things like that. I learned things that I'd never had heard of those terms before, but as he would unpack them, it was like, oh yeah, yeah, I see this all the time. So such a wealth of information and so, so helpful. And I love the fact that he was talking about neuroparenting, and that's that brain-based approach. Like, what, you know, how does this kiddo's brain work, and or how does it work differently, and what can we do to better support it? So for those of you who are familiar with the FASD, the FACETS training that I offer is actually not just for FASD. It is for, in fact, in the training, We refer to it as FANB, so fetal alcohol neurobehavioral. So whether you're talking any of the other things that we were talking about today, the trauma piece, anything, any kind of brain-based condition, the neurobehavioral model that I teach in the workshops, in the parent coaching, and even in our support group, we talk about that a lot. That's going to help your kiddo, whether or not they have an FASD or some other diagnosis, even if it's just the attachment or the trauma piece. Because I remember those early days where, by the time my kids reached their teen years and I'm like, what's going on here? I did this whole connected parenting thing. I attended multiple Empower to Connect conferences. My husband and I became parent trainers. We're doing the TBRI stuff. We're doing all this, and those things are working, but we're still missing something. Like, there's a big piece here. What's going on? And we recognize that it was the FASD, but all of the other stuff we had been learning, that was laying a foundation for us to understand that the brain has something to do with behavior. So trauma affects brain development, which will then affect behaviors of our kiddos. And it's not just behaviors that we can discipline or correct our kids, right? We can't fix the kid, because if it comes from the fact that their brain is wired differently, we have to take a different approach. And the same thing, if it's a brain that was prenatally exposed to alcohol or other drugs, it's even more wired differently. And it's different wired differently. But all of these approaches, understanding the brain helps. So I would highly recommend, if any of this conversation resonated with you today as an adoptive or foster parent or a kinship caregiver, I would highly recommend checking out our training, the training that I do, whether it be the parent coaching, whether it be the FASD training. Even if you don't know if your kiddo has an FASD, but you're recognizing that, well, there is that, language and communication problem. There is some sensory stuff going on. Maybe they are slow processors of information. Maybe they do seem much younger than they actually are. Any of these things, you would benefit. So like that free lunch and learn that's coming up on the 18th, is it the 20th? I think this podcast drops on the 18th. The lunch and learn that's coming up, the FASD, any of the trainings, even if it's FASD, whether or not you know anything about whether the kiddo you're caring for was exposed to alcohol in the womb, you will want to take advantage of that training. The monthly lunch and learn intro is free and it's online. And then I have, much more in-depth trainings if it really resonates with you. I have the coaching, and we have our support group for parents and caregivers. So many opportunities for you to get more help and support, because that was the other thing, that Dr. Brown mentioned at the end, was, connect with other parents. So, it's a very unique parenting journey. We can't compare or share parenting strategies with, biological parents of neurotypical kids, when we are parenting kids with adverse childhood experiences, with trauma, with prenatal exposure, with attachment issues. It's a different set of parenting tools altogether. It's a much harder journey, and we need one another as well. So that's another reason why that support group is super helpful. So much to unpack today. I hope you were encouraged and felt supported, and maybe learned some things that will help you on your parenting journey. I hope that you will check out the links in the show notes. I also have included a link to my personal website, sandraflack.com, where I blog, and my article that I wrote. I wrote a cornerstone article for Focus on the Family. It's an in-depth article on FASD. There's also some video modules that I recorded that go along with that. There's a link at my website to that article, so you can check that out. And of course, the link to justicefororphansny.org, so that you can check out all of our training and coaching and support group. It is all there. I hope you will check it out. Reach out to me. I would love to hear from you. If you are encouraged in any way, feel supported by this podcast. If you have a question, if there's a topic you would like us to cover, feel free to reach out, because I would love to hear from you. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast and leave a review, follow it, all of those things. Find us on social media. Justice for Orphans is on both Facebook or on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn, all three. As am I, Sandra Flack. You can find me as well on all three of those platforms. I would love to connect with you there. Again, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm grateful to have you along for the journey.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Adoption and Foster Care Journey podcast, brought to you by Justice for Orphans. We hope you were encouraged today. Please be sure to subscribe to this podcast and leave a review and share it with your fellow foster and adoptive parent friends so they can be encouraged too. Be sure to find and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Justice for Orphans. And check out our website for vital resources at justicefororphansny.org.